Hello, and welcome to episode 2 of our coverage of the Whistler Film Festival. The film officially opens tonight with the opening gala, and then will be Thursday through Sunday. We have 3 great guests on the show today. Actress, writer, and director Katie Boland has not one, but 3 films in the festival, 2 of which she acted in, and then a short film in which she is writer and director. You'll also hear from Ingrid Veninger, whose beautiful film Porcupine Lake, which had earlier screened at TIFF, is now getting its screening out west, and in conjunction with that, it is screening next to a documentary about the making of the film called The Other Side of Porcupine Lake. And I have both Ingrid and that film's director, Julian Pappas, on the decision to sort of create this hybrid project and why Ingrid decided to do that the way that she did. But my first guest is only 29, but she has basically been in the film business her entire life. She has appeared in everything from Naughty, In a Heartbeat, One True Love, Guilty Hearts, to films in Some Things That Say, Mount Pleasant, Daydream Nation, Sex After Kids, and more recently, Born to be Blue and Joseph and Mary. She's also appeared in the TV shows Rain. Her films in the festival include Cardinals, where she plays the role of Eleanor Walker, Never Saw It Coming, and the short film Lol's Eta, in which she is also writer-director. She has written a few other short films as well, and has directed a few of them, including A Subsequent Life and Fateful. This is my interview with Katie Boland. Before I get to the interview, I want to share a personal experience, I guess. Not really with Katie, but in a roundabout way, it involves Katie. There was a mini-series that she was in back in 2005 that I mentioned called Terminal City. And that was shot in my hometown of Victoria. In fact, it was shot in my high school. And I had already started acting at that point. I'd had an agent for a couple of years now, and I got to be an extra in several episodes of that show, including both at my high school, and then later on we shot up at the community college, where I would go to several years later. I believe Terminal City I shot the summer between grade 10 and 11, or like just the end of grade 10, or just the beginning of grade 11, one of those two. Just the beginning of grade 11, I think it was. And all the cast that I got to meet were lovely. I got to meet Katie very, very briefly in the course of a scene, and also Adam Butcher, who plays her brother in the film. I love that series, and I had a really good really good time working on it. Little 16-year-old me. But that's enough of that. Here is my conversation with Katie Boland.
Great to be speaking with you.
Katie Boland, hello, welcome.
Hi.
So, How does it feel to not have one, but two films being featured in the festival?
It feels amazing. I love Whistler. I just got here and I've never been here before. So it's like going to be so fun and such a wild ride. And it's actually very special because I have actually three films in. The third one is one that my mom directed. So we're getting to share this experience.
Is there a difference? You know, you're acting in one Cardinals and then you wrote and directed a short, Lil Zeta. Does your short film as a director, does that have a different sort of significance than the one that you're merely an actor in?
It's funny. I feel like every movie, when you look back on it in retrospect, sort of becomes emblematic of a time period in your life. So to me, one is not more significant than the other. When we were making Cardinals, my two best friends, Aiden Shipley and Grayson Moore, directed it, and we were all away together for a month making it. So that was a very significant time in my life and very meaningful. I guess I feel in a lot of ways closer to the film that I wrote and directed as well, because I just had to spend so much time editing it and being involved every step of the way. But no, I kind of don't have a favorite, if that makes sense.
What was it like? I mean, obviously Grayson and Aiden were your friends, but being directed by two directors simultaneously, how did you find that process?
It was definitely the first time I have done that, and I actually found it great. It was very easy because they are also so close and have worked together many times before. There's a shorthand, and sometimes one will take the emotional direction, whereas one will take over the more technical camera stuff. So it felt like the work was being delegated very equally. And I, after that film, I was like, why don't people do this more?
You were surrounded by friends on that film, obviously, Grayson and Aiden. And I know you've worked with Noah before as well. Does that make the job easier on a film set, knowing that you're amongst friends? Or is there a certain amount of increased pressure?
It definitely makes it easier. And Noah, Reed, and I joke that, like, we won't do a movie without each other because we've worked together so much in the past couple of years. No, it definitely makes it easier because there's that support, and you know that you can't really make a mistake. And if you are doing something completely wrong, you have a bunch of people there who know you really well and have your best interests at heart, so they're going to help you.
The film deals with quite heavy subject matter. Your character's mother, played by Sheila McCarthy, comes out of prison after a drunk driving incident. How do you sort of get into that zone where you sort of have to emotionally grasp all these dark things that have happened in the past?
I definitely had in-depth conversations. I had very in-depth conversations with Grayson and Aiden about what they were looking for with the character, and what was important to them. And then, I mean, I think the key to acting is really empathy. So I'm a pretty emotional and empathetic person. So it wasn't hard for me to imagine what it would feel like to be going through what my character was dealing with.
There seems a lot of reluctance on certainly the characters of Mark and Val to come to terms with exactly what happened in the past. Why do you think it's often difficult for us as people to sort of reconcile past actions or the past actions of others with how our lives are going now?
Well, I think when there's trauma involved, there's certain human instincts that just kick in, almost like a hormone, that control how we can think about it, how we talk about it, what we're willing to share about it, like sort of after effects of post-traumatic stress disorder, or if you're repressing things, or if you block things out. So I think that has some things are just too difficult to deal with head on every single day, or maybe even head on at all. And I also think, when you're talking about family history or things that aren't necessarily, a traumatic incident, but just sort of a shared historical understanding of your family, I think we all collaborate on this narrative of who our parents are, what role we play in a family. So then if one person breaks away from that or says like, no, the past was actually different, I remember it differently, it's very destabilizing for people, I think. Oftentimes I think it's easier to just remember, you know, difficult parts of your family or trauma as one thing and then be done discussing it.
Yeah. It strikes me that this movie is, given the subject matter, is sort of coming to us at a very interesting time with everything that we've heard coming out of the industry, both here and in the States. How do you think this film can maybe add to that conversation at all, or is that not necessarily something you guys are thinking about?
Well, it was interesting because obviously we made the movie over a year ago, so there wasn't all this discussion about sexual assault and sexual harassment. But I do think that it's great that the movie is coming out now in sort of this ripe environment for really having honest conversations. But I think the movie is, I think at its core, this movie is about silence and how damaging silence is, and how if you don't let people, specifically victims, speak, it's traumatizing for a number of people. So I hope that the film lets the audience firstly think that there's not just like one type of victim and there's not one right way to deal with having been victimized, but also that if we're forced to keep these secrets, ultimately we're made sick by them.
So, moving from Cardinals to your other film, Lolzita, which I think, considering you're the writer-director, seems a little more personal to you, where did you get the idea to tell this story?
I had become very fascinated with these young women online who were a little younger than me, but used their sexuality on Instagram as their business and their brand. And so I was just interested in that sort of online persona. I also have a cousin who exists like that on the internet, like lives in a very small town, has a relatively small life, but has hundreds of thousands of followers on Instagram, and her posts are very sexualized for someone who's underage. So without any judgment, or really any strong opinion on it one way or another, I just thought, oh, it's very interesting that with this new wave of feminism, young women are empowered by their sexuality, but are also victims of it. So I just started thinking about that. And then I started thinking about how I exist online as kind of a completely different person in a lot of ways. And I'm very obsessed with social media and how that's affected me. And how that online persona is in some ways like as real and as valuable as I am in real life. And so I just was thinking a lot about female identity, and I guess that's where it was born.
You know, you've been in this industry almost your whole life. So you started before all the social media stuff happened. How long did it take you to get comfortable with the idea that people know you and now there's easier access to you?
Yeah, it's funny. Like, I never think of myself as someone who's, I don't really have a relationship with celebrity, or so I guess I never got used to that idea because I never thought about it like that. Like, I sort of thought, oh, you know, my friends follow me. And then what I found interesting is sometimes I'll meet like a director or something in real life, and sort of halfway through the conversation, you realize that they know a lot about you from your Instagram. So it's almost interesting, like how people that you're going to collaborate with creatively can like really build a picture of who they think you are before you've met. But truthfully, I mean, I'm a person who puts a lot out there online. Like I write personal essays about very personal things that are happening in my life. So for me, like that's never been a struggle. Like I have no relationship with privacy, I guess.
Do you think, you know, given the very digital world that we live in, are you noticing a different standards for females online than versus males?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think for sure. I think that different standards exist everywhere in society for women versus men. But absolutely, online.
Now, you were in Cardinals, you were directed by your friends, and in Lolzita, you're directing your friends. I know you're friendly with both Sarah and Lauren. What was that experience like? Did that make it easier for you as a director?
Yes, absolutely. Because I got these amazing actors like Don McKellar and Sarah Gadon and Jesse Camacho, who is one of my best friends, to be in the movie. And then it's so easy. Like, I didn't have to direct anybody, really. They're all geniuses, I think. So I just was like, yeah, do whatever you want.
And of course, Don McKellar has a lot of experience as both an actor and a writer director. Did he give you any advice, or did he just sort of let you do your thing?
He was firstly, it was really kind that he did this movie. Like, he didn't have to, you know? So he basically just let me do my thing. I remember when he read the script, he had some questions which were helpful and ultimately made the script better. I was surprised all these people were willing to do my movie, but also surprised that they were just willing to let me take charge.
Do you think that you're experience as an actor has helped your directing and vice versa?
Absolutely, yeah. I think, like, I learned to direct on film sets as an actress, and I think being a director does make me a better actress.
You've been in this industry, you know, since you were a young girl, a teenager, and you always hear, you know, horror stories of, you know, former child stars gone bad. How have you weathered that transition? Was it an easy one for you to make?
It was very easy because my mother, who is a filmmaker and who directed the other film that I have in Whistler, she's always, I don't know, but in my family, being in the film industry is sort of normal, and there's no reason to not be grounded. And I'm very close to my family, to my brother and my father also. So there was never sort of a difficulty that way. What I found hard more was once I was no longer in high school and acting, and I would have like a couple months off between jobs, I did really struggle with that. But ultimately that's why I became a writer.
So your third film, which you're also in, is being directed by your mother. What was that experience like for you? Having, you know, here you are being directed by someone who you've known your entire life. What was that relationship like on set?
Yeah, so my mom and I worked together often. I also produced that film, Never Saw It Coming, that she directed as well as acted in it. So it's a really like easy shorthand. Like, I prefer to work with people that I'm very close to and know well. I just feel like there's more safety. And ultimately, I think that the work is better when you can work with people you're really close to. So for us, it's just like old hat. We're just used to it.
You mentioned this is your first time in Whistler. What are you looking forward to most about the festival?
I'm very much looking forward to seeing all of my friends from across the country that are coming, because it's a very well-attended festival. I'm also looking forward to exploring Whistler a little bit. I don't think I'll go skiing, but now that I'm saying that out loud, I'm like, I don't know, I'm here, maybe I should.
Given the nature of the film business in Canada, how important are independent film festivals such as Whistler?
Incredibly important, because TIFF, for example, there's so few slots for Canadian films, and that's really like, that is, TIFF is a corporation, it's a business now, and it's a market, and they're selling the biggest films in the world. So to have like an independent festival like Whistler is, one, a real chance to celebrate Canadian film, to allow audiences to see it, and to allow filmmakers and people who can work together within the Canadian system to network and to meet each other. So I think it's incredibly important.
So, do you have any, besides your own, obviously, any one film that you're really excited to see?
Yeah, I'm very excited to see The Definites, that my friends Mackenzie Donaldson and Hannah Cheeseman made, and my friend Mike Cedar is in, so I'm really looking forward to that.
Well, you've got three films. You got Lol Zeta, and you got Cardinals. Katie Boland, thanks so much for jumping on the phone today.
Thanks so much for having me. This was a pleasure.
No worries. Enjoy the festival.
Thank you.
Alrighty, ciao.
Bye.
That was my conversation with actress, writer, and director Katie Boland. She has three films in the festival, Cardinals and Never Saw It Coming, which she is an actress in. The latter of which of those is directed by her mother, as you probably heard her mention in the interview. And she's also a star and writer-director of the short film, Lol Zeta. My next guest also got her start as an actress, appearing in a wide variety of TV movies and TV series, including two episodes as Siobhan in La Femme Nikita, as well as other shows such as The Zach Files and Within These Walls. But she's more known as a writer director. Some of her credits include Am I a Good Person? Am I a Bad Person? Modra, Only, The Animal Project, and He Hated Pigeons. Her most recent film actually got its start at the Whistler Film Festival in terms of a manifesto of women filmmakers telling stories with central female characters. And for her, the result was Porcupine Lake. It is a film about friendship, love, sexuality, and discovering who you are. She searched far and wide for the cast. One of the lead actresses, this was her very first film, and the other one comes from Australia. The film is Porcupine Lake, and the director, writer-director, is Ingrid Veninger, and I spoke with her earlier today about the film. Ingrid Veninger, hello. Hi. Welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing excellent. So
it's pretty early. I mean, no, now you're in Toronto. I kept thinking you're in Vancouver, so it was going to be a three-hour time difference, but we're on the same clock right now.
Yeah, let me tell you, I used to have to do interviews at 7 a.m. in Vancouver, and it wasn't the funnest in the world.
Yeah, I believe it.
So let's talk about Porcupine Lake. I really love this little film, and I know it actually got its start at Whistler Film Festival, where it's playing this weekend. The idea for you to make a sort of a coming of age stories about teen girls, do you remember how that started for you?
Yeah, oh my God. And you just put me back to when I was writing the script and I had to be in the skin of 13 again. And it's, you know, it can be an uncomfortable, awkward whirlwind place to be. I've wanted to tell the story for about 5 years, and Porcupine Lake's my sixth feature, and I finally felt ready to sort of delve into the world of girls and the power dynamic and the intimacy of that kind of friendship. And you're right, it was completely motivated by Melissa Leo standing up at the Whistler Film Festival in 2013 when I was winning an award for The Animal Project. And at the podium, I sort of launched into this initiative that I had envisioned for six Canadian women to get together every month for 6 months and for each of us to write an original screenplay. And of course, I was hoping for some kind of seed money. So at the podium, I pitched that there would be these six scripts, and if anyone stood up, they would get a first look at the scripts. And I was hoping for $6,000 so the money could be shared amongst us, $1,000 each. And Melissa Leo stood up, and that was the beginning of the Punk Films Fem Lab, where Denise Gesterhazy and Mars and Sophie Duras from Quebec and Anais Granofsky and myself and Michelle Latimer got together. And it was in that circle that we started talking about the kinds of stories that we wanted to see on screen and the kinds of friendships we had growing up, and that's how Porcupine Lake was born.
Is that why you give Melissa Leo I think you put her in the credits as like foremother or something?
Yeah, foremother. I mean, after we all wrote these scripts, we went to her place, had a slumber party, and she gave us feedback, and she's been with me through the entire process. I showed her a rough cut, and she gave me feedback on that. So when I asked her what kind of credit she wanted, she didn't want some sort of industry executive producer, and we brainstormed back and forth, and she wanted foremother. So she's officially the foremother of Porcupine Lake, both in the credits of the film and in the credit block on the poster, which I think is cool.
No, I know casting was very important to you, and you had talked about wanting to get at least one of the girls in the film who had never acted before, and I know that's how you found Charlotte. Why was that important to you to tell this story?
Yeah, I don't know if it was so much that I wanted someone who'd never acted before. I worked with casting director Michael Yerxa, and we put the call out far and wide. And Charlotte Salisbury was one of the young actors that came in the very first round. It took about 18 months. I saw almost 100 girls. And I first met her when she was 13. And she had never acted in anything before, and she was incredible. She had such a strong ability to listen, and the dialogue just came out so naturally, and she had this incredible behavior. So I had her in my sights, and when I continued writing the second draft, I had her in my mind, and there was a bit of urgency because I thought, okay, I mean, girls grow up fast, and I knew I needed to make this film before she was too old. So we actually started shooting with her when she was 15, and I felt like she was right on the edge. And Lucinda Armstrong Hall, who plays Kate, I met at the Melbourne Queer Film Festival when I was showing a film called He Hated Pigeons in 2016. I met her. She is the daughter of one of my closest childhood friends from when I was 12 years old. And Lucinda was 13 when I met her. And yeah, she was 13 when she made the film. And she'd had a bit more acting experience in Melbourne.
What do you think it is about... There's a certain, I think, innocence when you're a child and sort of, you know, certain... maybe unsureness at that age. What do you think it is about these types of stories in involving children that are so effective in sort of helping us to discover ourselves, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's anyone who's been 13 and has encountered a friend that they want to impress or they're challenged by can relate to the story, because yes, there's an innocence and there's a curiosity and tenderness, and that age of 12, 13 is so fleeting. It's such a small window before you sort of go full throttle into adolescence. And it's a time where we're trying to walk in our own footsteps a little bit and break away from our parents. And it's confusing because there's all these messages out in the world about who we're supposed to be, who we should be, what we should wear, what we should be watching, what we should be listening to. And it can get confusing. So I dedicate the film to young girls working to be themselves, because I think that is a constant process, but it certainly started for me very dramatically when I was 13 years old.
There's a couple of scenes that have some frank dialogue, you know, when you're talking about the human anatomy, and that can, I know from high school experience, that can get a little awkward for teenagers. How did you have that discussion with those girls and sort of navigate that dialogue?
Yeah, that was tricky stuff, because It was uncomfortable. It was uncomfortable to say penis and boner, and we talked about the language. We had individual Skype calls. There weren't rehearsals per se. The girls met for the first time on the first day of the shoot, but I definitely had a lot of conversations with them. And when they were uncomfortable about some of that dialogue as themselves, it was sort of perfect because the characters were also really uncomfortable. And in the documentary, it's cool because you really have a look behind the curtain and how we work through some of those scenes, and especially that forest scene where Kate picks up the stick and she's trying to, you know, basically measure the stick against the size of her brother's boner. Spoiler alert there, but you could see their discomfort beforehand, and Charlotte puts her hands to her face and goes like, oh my God. And I say, come on, Kate, you got to teach your stuff. So they really embrace this kind of teacher, pupil, more experienced, less experienced. And Lucinda as an actor just sort of took that on. But yeah, it was a lot of conversations to ease into those scenes, but they were important. They were important to me because I think that power dynamic really exists. And in the film, it kind of reverses, you know, the character of Kate seems like the more dominant one, but at the end you realize she's actually the more needy, insecure, vulnerable one. And as we know in life, those dynamics are shifting all the time. Sometimes we know less, and then suddenly we become the teacher for somebody else.
There's a lot of discussion, you know, B being from the city and Kate being from the small town, the attitudes of the two girls are different. Why do you think small towns are often really effective in telling stories such as this one?
Well, the place, the setting of Port Severn and the Barrie area is really true to my own experience when we first came from Czechoslovakia. One of the only jobs my dad could get was managing a snack bar, actually 10 minutes from where we shot Porcupine Lake. And my mother had a job in Toronto, so they had to be apart for many years. And my mother and I would come up and see my dad. And so I was immersed in that world from the age of 8 to 12, pretty much every weekend and through my summer holidays and winter breaks. And, you know, I was playing with I was reversing, I think, the way we typically see that dynamic of the city girl coming to the country and bestowing her knowledge on everyone and being the, you know, the wise one. I sort of reversed it and made the city girl a little more naive, and the country girl more experienced because she's a part of this big family and she has an older sister who's got a child and she's got an older brother who's out in the world and their life is kind of unsupervised because the mother's holding down three jobs and so the kids have to grow up very, very quickly. So and that was my experience. I was an only child and I thought I knew all this stuff coming from Toronto, and I got blasted with some real information in my time up north. So I was really trying to play that sort of true to my experience.
One interesting note that I got when I received the screener was to say, listen with headphones. Why was that choice made to sort of have this enhanced sound when you're watching this movie?
Oh, well, so much better with headphones, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of subtle sounds in the source music that plays in the snack bar and in the score where you feel it kind of come up from under the water, or from under the earth, or through the trees. And we've got so many subtle sounds created by my sound designer, Jacob Thiessen, and Braden Sauter, the production sound recordist, was on set getting wild sounds all the time from location. So really, when you have those headphones on, if you have to watch it off a laptop, you get the full experience of sound and image. And of course, when you're in the theater, you get our 5-1 mix that we did at Deluxe, and Eric Apps, who I've worked with now on 5 features, really takes painstaking efforts to put sounds in certain places so you get immersed in the world of the hot and hazy summertime sensation. But you know, sometimes on a laptop a lot of that gets lost. So I just say, if you could put on headphones, it's going to sound a hell of a lot better.
Coming of age stories are nothing new, but we often tend to see films geared more towards young men. Why do you think there's still a bit of a reluctance, perhaps, to have a open discussion about female sexuality?
Yeah, I mean, I was really, you're absolutely right. We've seen a lot of great coming of age stories, especially in Canada, out of Quebec, Leolo and Mon Oncle Antoine and Crazy, which is a film I love by Jean-Marc Vallée, and more recently Sleeping Giant and Closet Monster by Stephen Dunn. And there's not that many stories about girls and the coming of age of girls out of Canada specifically. In the rest of the world, I mean, I love a film called We Are the Best, and Celine Sciamma, who's a filmmaker I adore, she made a film called Tomboy and Girlhood and Water Lilies. There's been some great films out of Scandinavia and Germany and France. And I had to really think about why we don't tell those stories so much in Canada. I mean, we have Anne of Green Gables, and Ginger Snaps, but that particular age of girls at 13, I think is tricky territory, because fortunately I found Lucinda, who was really 13, and Charlotte, who I think was really 13 at heart when we made the film, and those are her mother's words. She's sort of a young 15-year-old when we were shooting. You know, these girls are going through the experience that the characters are going through. There's kind of a parallel. And it's very different if you have 16, 17-year-olds playing these roles. There's an authenticity that comes from really being that age, which again is sort of between childhood and adolescence. And it's hard to develop a trust with the families that have to be a part of saying, yes, I'll let my daughter be a part of this, because parents know an experience of being in a film at this time in their life, especially that deals with queer material, where this is really, in my mind, a love story between two girls, could affect their real lives in ways that is completely unknown. So it takes a lot of maturity and trust and confidence and communication to be a part of something like this. And they had to have so much courage. And it's a responsibility. I mean, we have an ongoing relationship now that extends way beyond just the making of the film. We're forever bonded because of this, you know, intense and immersive experience of making the film at that particular time of life. So I guess it's a number of factors involved why we don't see these stories. I think we see a lot more stories featuring adolescents and older girls, and usually in those stories, even if there's a queer subtext, there's some sort of male object of desire. But in Porcupine Lake, there's none of that. It's really about intense friendship of these two girls.
Speaking of immersive experience, you made a decision early on that you were gonna have somebody make behind the scenes documentary of the film and of your process. Why did you decide to do that?
That's a really good question, and I think it stems from what we were just talking about, that I wanted to somehow archive the experience of the entire process for especially the two young leads, because when you finish making a film, the attention goes on the result. Will it get into festivals? What will people think? Will it get sold? What will the response be to the film and the world? And the memory of everything that went on behind the scenes can get a little lost. So I guess I wanted to time capsule the entire process from writing and through casting and production into post-production and finishing the film, to have something that the girls can maybe look back on in their 20s and 30s and go, all right, like that moment and those dinners that we had every night and that birthday party and the dance party we had at the end of that crazy night of shooting, and all of those things that can kind of get lost over time, I wanted to preserve. And I guess also, for myself, I mean, now I'm doing my master's at York University, and I'm, you know, sort of resetting myself, and I don't know what kind of filmmaker I'm going to be on the other side of this degree. And that makes me excited. But at the same time, I've been doing these DIY low budget films for almost 10 years. And I love doing film. I love making films with a small crew and sort of having a film camp experience where we're all staying together and eating together and waking up together. And so I guess I wanted to document that and have that be sort of something maybe film students or other filmmakers or film lovers that want to look behind the scenes and at the process to be able to look at, because people often ask me how I make these low budget films, and it's one thing to talk about and describe it with words, but it's another thing to actually be able to see how we did it. So I was so glad that Julian Pappas was down to be with us through the entire process, and now we have this feature film doc that's playing at the same time as the fiction, which I think is going to be so cool.
And I gotta ask, did you wear the crown to the premiere?
I'm gonna bring the crown to Whistler. I've got it packed in my suitcase, and I'm gonna wear it at the premiere on Saturday.
Well, the film is Porcupine Lake. I really, really enjoyed this film, as I did enjoy the documentary as well. Ingrid Veninger, thanks so much for your time, and best of luck in Whistler.
Thanks so much.
No worries. Cheers.
Cheers.
And that was my interview with Ingrid Veninger, the writer, director, and producer of the wonderful little film Porcupine Lake, which will be screening this week at the Whistler Film Festival. As you may have heard Ingrid mention in that interview, she did something a little bit different for this film. She got somebody to film her making the movie in what was essentially a fly-on-the-wall making-of documentary. Because she said she'll probably never make another film quite like the way she made this one again. And she also did it as a gift to the girls, if you will. The girls being Charlotte and Lucinda, who were in the film. As something they could look back on in 10, 20, 30 years from now. So she got in touch with Julian Pappas, who she knows from York University, and asked him if he was willing to be a one-man film crew to film this making-of documentary, the stipulation being that he couldn't have any interactions with the casts, specifically the girls, and just sort of, you know, document the process of making this film in the small town while they're sort of all sleeping in cabins, and, you know, it was a three-week shoot in the summer. So I talked to Julian about his thoughts on this slightly unusual film about the making of a film and his thoughts on the film in general. This is my conversation with Julian Pappas, the director of The Other Side of Porcupine Lake. Julian Pappas, hello. Welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
No problem.
So you made a documentary, The Other Side of Porcupine Lake. What was the conversation you had with Ingrid? I know she was her former professor. She's like, I'm making this movie, and I want you to make a documentary of me making this movie.
Well, she had said that she really, before this film, she had never really wanted to document her process. But because with this one, she was going to be working with very young actors, and she thought it would be a very important time to document for her young actors to watch back she wanted to do it. And so she asked me if I was interested in directing it. And I was really excited about it, even though, like, we weren't super close, but I was a former student of hers, and she, I guess we had similar tastes in cinema, and we hit it off from there and started making the movie.
You know, given that this is a film about filmmaking and that process, what did you learn about your own process of making a film while documenting somebody else's?
I think I actually learned a lot about my filmmaking style, and also just me as a person and what I was comfortable with. The documentary itself, it has a very gentle and quiet way about it, and it's not a very pushy or in your face kind of documentary. And the way that I filmed everyone was very much in that same way of being observed from further away and not getting into the thick of it. And I learned that that's what works for me, and that all I could really do was film that way and film that what I thought was interesting. And I think Ingrid would have made a different documentary if she had directed this one, because she's a different filmmaker. But I thought it was important to learn that. And just by being on a set, it sort of helped me realize more of what I wanted to make and how I wanted to make it.
How did the practicality of something like this work? Because here you are with the camera, you're essentially your own one-man film crew, but then you're filming other people with cameras and lights who are setting up shots. So how did you coordinate all of that?
Well, because I mainly worked with a very lightweight camera. I was using the Sony A7S II, and I had a zoom lens. So because to work around any kind of production equipment or, you know, people working and getting in the shot, I had to be very agile, and I had to be able to move around a lot or reframe really quickly. And flexible, basically, was the main way I would work on this film. And so, yeah, just by having those tools at my disposal, I was able to frame shots that were more interesting and tried to not have, you know, light stands in it. But if they were, it was okay. But yeah, I tried to bake that into the way that I filmed and the tools that I used to actually get interesting shots and things that people would actually want to watch.
One thing that struck me when I was watching it is just how almost guerrilla both Ingrid's process was for this film. There was sort of a scene on the dock that you guys just snuck into, shot, and then shot away. What can maybe aspiring filmmakers and aspiring indie filmmakers learn from watching a film like this?
Well, I think they can realize that, I mean, hopefully when you see someone making a film and when you see someone doing something that you want to be doing, representation is important. And when someone else is doing something, it makes it easier for them, you to be like, oh, I can do this. And Ingrid's way of filmmaking is very much a DIY kind of style, and she finds ways to make things work. And hopefully any kind of young filmmakers watching it will realize that they can do it too, and that you might not have huge budgets to be able to afford, you know, different kinds of location permits and all those sorts of things, but there are other ways of maneuvering around that to actually get the shots you want and get the locations you want. So hopefully it's inspiring to young filmmakers. Hopefully they don't do anything crazy and break laws and what have you, but there's a way to work within that and find that gray area.
I was, you know, chatting with Ingrid about this and the fact that she used a largely non-professional cast for the film as someone who was the observer of this process. What did you find about that and sort of the authenticity that, you know, first-time actors can bring to a role like this and to a film like this?
I mean, it was really interesting because it was a mix. There were some actors on the set who were like extreme, they were professionals who've been in the film industry for a really long time. But then to be working with people who this might be their first experience or second, but they're still very early on. But they were very, like, they had so much energy to it, and they were just really interesting to watch because they didn't have any kind of airs about anything, and they were very, like, gung-ho about the whole experience, and they were excited about it. And, I mean, it was a similar sort of thing of wanting to document it for the young girls in the film in Porcupine Lake, but also it was just interesting to see how these people were interacting on set, and since it was their first experience too. Yeah, they were just very interesting people, and you don't get to experience that often, and I think they brought a different kind of energy to the set.
And so now the film is not only making its world premiere at the Whistler Film Festival, but it's playing alongside Porcupine Lake. What's that feeling like for you?
It's really cool just because, I mean, it's great that it's playing at the Whistler Film Festival because Porcupine Lake got its start at the Whistler Film Festival in 2015, and where, like, Melissa Leo donated the money to start the Punk Films Fem Lab, and Ingrid was able to start writing Porcupine Lake because of that. And it's just a really special thing to be able to return to the Whistler Film Festival this year. Well, it's my first time, but Ingrid is returning. And we're both bringing our sister features, as we like to call it, and that show two sides of how this of this film, of Porcupine Lake, how the film was made and the actual film. I think that's a really cool thing. And it's great that Whistler was able to do that just because that's not something that usually happens. And it might not happen again either as these films go on to play other film festivals. So it's a pretty special thing. And I'm really excited about it.
Is it harder to get distribution and screenings for a documentary? Is there still this idea that documentaries don't sell as much as features and aren't as interesting, or do you think we're starting to see a change in that?
I think there is still that idea, unfortunately, that the, like, documentaries don't make money. But I don't know how true that is, just from the interest of people that I know who go to see lots of documentaries. And I think with the new, with, like, the focus on VOD and Netflix and what have you, I think documentaries have had a bit of a resurgence in a way, and more people are interested in them. And then I think also with this kind of thing, with this documentary specifically, you don't really get these kinds of experiences at a film festival, especially where a film will play and then a fiction feature will play, and then you can also see how that film was made in the same day at the same film festival. And I think that's pretty cool, so hopefully people will be interested in that. But yeah, I think it's changing a little bit more where people are interested in documentaries again, and I think all the different platforms have really helped that.
I spoke with Ingrid a little bit about this, but, you know, given the subject matter of the film and sort of it got its start at Whistler with this manifesto.
Yeah.
Where do you think we are in terms of female filmmakers being able to tell their own stories?
I think we're still, I do still think it's, like, in its, unfortunately, like, early stages of actually having the tide turning, but I do think in the last few years there have been a lot of there's been a great push towards that, and more female filmmakers are getting noticed and are actually able to make work and getting things funded. But I think it's just going to get better and better in the coming years, because I mean, it has a long way to go, unfortunately. Like, it's not the greatest right now, but hopefully, like, more and more female filmmakers will keep making work, and that'll inspire, like, the next generation, and it'll keep going until there isn't such a huge imbalance.
Although, you know, you are the director of this documentary, but how closely did you work with Ingrid on the editing process in terms of, you know, what to include in the actual film?
Early on in the editing process for the documentary, I worked a lot with my co-editor, Jesse Wyatt. We went through all the footage. We had around 120 to 150 hours of footage. And we made an assembly, which was 8 hours long, and then continued there and chipped away into a rough cut. And after that point, Ingrid watched our rough cut, and then we keep working, and she would give us notes. And then when it got into the fine cut stage, when we were really, like, cutting stuff down and trying to get it into what it is now at an 85 minute time frame, Ingrid came into the process, and we worked pretty closely in terms of trying some stuff out, and she had her own ideas, and we always try them out. So yeah, in the end, in the rough cut to fine cut stage and then finishing the film, she worked quite closely with me on the edit.
What was that like working with and collaborating with someone who is essentially your subject in the film, and now she's working with you to finish that story?
It was really interesting. I mean, I don't know if anyone else is really, I don't think that's a very common practice. Usually the subject is not the producer on the film. But I think because of that, she had a different stake in the process, but also she brought different ideas to the film because she was the subject. And I think those ideas would not be the same if she was just the producer. And I think that was really helpful, because at a certain point as a director, and I shot everything as well, and you get to a point in the process where you're not seeing things in the way that maybe you should or that you did at the beginning. And her perspective was a very, she was in it. Like it was a very specific perspective of having lived this. And I think that really helped in the end. Because the more different the perspective that you can get on a film project from your crew, I think the better for the project in the end.
Does it give it a certain amount of authenticity knowing that she's in the room with you and she's helping you through this?
Yeah, I would say so. Do you mean like
because she is the subject, and then she is also, you know, with you there editing the film about her? There must be like an added layer of authenticity to that and the process.
Yeah, for sure. And I think there's a certain like level of investment that she had in the project, and she was extremely invested in it, and she wanted it to be true to her process, and she also didn't want to shy away from anything. She didn't want to not show things that might show her in like a slightly negative light. Like, she didn't want to make it a puff piece that completely showed her as like the most wonderful person to work with or anything like that. Like, she wanted to have it, yeah, have a certain level of authenticity and truth to it, and how she shows how she works with actors and how she works with her crew and what the experience is like for her. And she really just wanted it to be real. So her being in the editor room really helped, because that informed the choices we made. And I think bringing her investment and her truth to it really helped in the end.
Has it sunk in yet that the film's going to have its world premiere later in the week?
Yeah, I think so. As you get, about a month ago, it didn't seem real. But now that it's, like, this week, it's definitely feels way more, like, immediate and upon me. But you saying that actually makes it feel more real, to be honest.
Well, the film is The Other Side of Porcupine Lake, making its world premiere this week at the Whistler Film Festival. Julian Pappas, thanks so much for your time today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Alrighty, cheers. And that was my conversation with Julian Pappas, the director of the documentary The Other Side of Porcupine Lake, which chronicles the making of the feature film Porcupine Lake, and they'll be screening back-to-back at the Whistler Film Festival. That's the show for today. We're going to have at least one other show of Whistler Film Festival artists up on Friday. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you then. Bye for now.